So what we were talking about last time was how to get heat energy, which is just the energy of vibration of molecules and atoms, into and out of matter by way of light. And we're sort of starting on that by talking about black body radiation, to just sort of touch base with what we've been doing. We've got vibration, which is part of what heat is, just the motion of the atoms. And this vibration can create an oscillating electric field. And then the oscillating field can make a light, which is just a wave of electric and magnetic radiation, of fluctuations of the electric and magnetic field, that you put them together in just the right way and send them along, and they can propagate themselves through empty space and carry energy around. We talked about a black body is an object that can oscillate at any frequency. And I'm writing the Greek letter nu for frequency because I'm lazy, but now I'll write the word frequency so that I'm not completely lazy, just so you are aware. Next time I'm lazier and don't write frequency, you'll know. Or if you read it in a book or something, the Greek letter nu is frequency. So a black body is sort of analogous to a musical instrument that has all of the notes. And it will turn out that most solids and liquids that we'll encounter in earth sciences are pretty good black bodies. The solid earth is pretty much a good black body. It can oscillate in any different frequency, so that means it can do this trick of emitting light at pretty much any frequency. And then, of course, this trick is a two-way street. Light can excite an oscillating electric field in matter, like if you were to stand over a piano and put down the take off the dampers, so you let all the strings loose and then sing a note into it and then stop singing, you'll hear the string echoing back the note that you sang to it. So that's an example of the vibration coming in and stimulating the oscillation. So the same is true with light. This is a two-way street. Anything that can absorb light also can emit light by this sort of mechanism. So there is a characteristic frequency spectrum. The colors, as the intensity of the different colors of the infrared light, we can't see them as colors, but that's sort of what they are, is different colors of light. And that's called a black body spectrum. And we talked about that at some length last time. So the intensity, how bright it is, as a function of the frequency. And now you can see my laziness. I just wrote the Greek letter nu instead of writing the word frequency. And that spectrum is sort of a hump. It's got a peak, and it's sort of like a bell curve kind of a thing. And we learned the sort of scientific, in history of science kind of curiosity, that the cause of this hump is quantum mechanics. So if Isaac Newton was all she wrote about physics, classical mechanics, where everything kind of fits according to our intuition and there's no kind of spooky stuff, what we would have expected from the spectrum of light coming from some object is this thing that just goes up forever. And the real world doesn't do that. It dramatically doesn't do that. It does this. So this is the ultraviolet catastrophe. And then this is the observed black body spectrum, and it's brought to us by quantum mechanics. So this difference here, this is the effect of quantum mechanics, which says that the energy levels of the oscillators, these atomic vibrations, when you start getting into the very, very energetic light, the X-rays and ultraviolet and all of that, the energy levels are so far apart that at normal room sort of temperatures, you just can't afford to excite the higher vibrational energy states. So, you know, it sort of clamps down on that part of the spectrum. So what we end up with is that black body spectrum, and we're going to talk about the implications of that spectrum today. That's sort of where we're going. But just to sort of polish off our review of quantum mechanics, there's this sort of wave particle duality. It's a weird theory. It makes no sense whatsoever. But things that we normally think of as particles with weight and everything, like electrons, also have sort of a wave character. So we talked about an experiment last time where electrons diffract. They diffract each other. The waves can cancel each other out. Which only makes sense if you think of the electrons as a wave, because you have a positive, you know, a peak and then a negative trough, and you add them together, you get nothing. That's the way waves work, not particles, but in quantum mechanics, particles have some wave character, and so electrons do that. And then also energy comes in chunks in quantum mechanics. So the vibrational energy states that we were talking about putting energy into to make the electric field oscillate to shoot off some light, at some point those energy levels get so far apart that you can't afford to fill them. So that's a case of the energy coming in chunks. Now, one thing that I told you last time about how this all works that may you probably didn't think too much about, but it comes up here. And it's sort of an illustration of how a new theory has to sort of match all of the accomplishments of the old theory. It has to be better than the old theory. So quantum mechanics is a new theory. Classical is an old theory. I said that the frequency of the light, in order for this trick to happen, the frequency of the light has to be the same as the frequency of the oscillator. So the oscillator you think of as weights with springs, and it has some characteristic frequency that it likes to vibrate at, like a string on a piano only plays one note, or on a guitar or whatever. And so this is classical theory, and it makes, you know, good sense that you know the frequencies, you're going to wag it at some frequency, and then it has to be able to vibrate at that frequency to absorb. So how does quantum mechanics do this? Quantum mechanics says that the energy levels between the excited states of the oscillator, the energy levels equals are set by the frequency of the oscillation. So, you know, this is where if you had a very, very high frequency light like the ultraviolet light, why isn't this shining ultraviolet light? Because the oscillators, the energy levels are so far apart that the amount of thermal energy in this piece of chalk, which is nice and cool, isn't enough to get there. So this is how we calculated those energy levels. And As it turns out, light, being energy, also comes in chunks. So it's not exempt from this. It comes in chunks called photons, which are sort of chunks of energy. Now, light is still waves because you can diffract it and add them together and interfere and all that sort of wave kind of stuff that we talked about. But it also comes in these chunks. And the energy of those chunks, so energy of a photon of light, is equal to, just as it turns out, h, this same Planck's constant, and the frequency of the light. So if h is the same thing on both sides, then the frequency of the light has to be the same as the frequency of the oscillator. So the new theory, you know, gives us in this case exactly what the old theory gave us, but it's kind of in a different formalism. So if you want to replace an old theory with a new theory, it's got to do just as good as the old theory did at what the old theory was good at. And then one last little thing, just for your general kind of amusement, and you know, if you want to impress someone at a party, you can bring this up, just how well educated you are here at the University of Chicago. There's this idea that's kind of in the zeitgeist, Schrodinger's cat. So Schrodinger's cat, you remember we had this experiment, and we put a little sensor here to measure whether electrons go through one slit or the other. And when there was no sensor, the electron was kind of in its wave character, and there was like a 50% chance that it went through one slit and a 50% chance it went through the other, and it ended up interfering with itself. So it essentially sort of went through both slits at once. And then you put the sensor on it, and now it doesn't go, now the probability, you measure that it goes through here, and the probability that it went through there is 100%. You know that because you measured it. And it does this weird trick called collapsing the wave function. It sort of prods the electron to be a particle again instead of a wave. And so Schrodinger's cat was an experiment where you take this sensor and you attach it to some sort of a device that has some poison in it. So poison, and then you have a cat in a box. And there's a cat in a box, very unhappy cat. And if the electron happens to go through that slit, the apparatus breaks the poison and kills the cat. So the thought experiment, the thing that Schrodinger said was, say you put this whole thing in a box and you do the experiment, but you don't look at it yet. Before you look at it, you haven't collapsed the wave function yet. And so that means that the electron goes through both slits. You know, there's a superposition of it goes through the slit or it doesn't go through the slit. And so the cat then is a superposition of alive and dead until you open the box and look and see. And then suddenly it's one or the other. Now that seems a little weird to me because, you know, can't the cat look at it enough to collapse the wave function? What if a janitor opened it up and didn't know what the experiment was? You know, it's just kind of another demonstration of sort of quantum weirdness. But, you know, now you can make oblique references to Schrodinger's cat and impress people or whatever. It's just kind of cool. That's what it means. It sort of fits into this. So I hope you appreciate it enough to make it worth sitting on the floor for. Yes, question?
Totally random fact, but this is in the new Coen Brothers movie. The main character teaches the
actually. And he's probably a lunatic, right?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. It'll do it to you. Okay. It's a good movie, I hear. All right. So, now, back to business. We have to talk about the climate of the Earth. There are two things about this black body spectrum that matter to us. So here we're going to have frequency again. Frequency of the light and the intensity, and it kind of looks like that because of quantum mechanics. One thing is that when you change the temperature, the thing gets more intense. So as you dial up the temperature, this clump gets bigger. And another thing that happens, so another thing that happens is that the peak shifts from to higher wavelengths, or sorry, higher frequencies as you raise the temperature. So the bit about it shifts toward higher frequency light sort of makes sense. It should make sense to us now, because we know that the reason why the curve goes back down is because of quantum mechanics, because you can't afford those energy levels. But if you have more thermal energy to spend, then maybe you can start affording some of those higher energy levels. And this is why an electric burner only glows in the infrared when it's at room temperature. But if you heat it up, you know, all the way with turning the electricity on, it'll heat up and sort of glow red hot. And if you could heat it up even further, it would glow white hot, and then ultimately it could glow, you know, where the main light coming from it might even be in the ultraviolet. There are some stars out there that are so hot that they, you know, mostly shine in the ultraviolet. And so that sort of makes sense in terms of the quantum mechanics. Now, the part that really, and so the sun, for example, is like a black body, but it's so hot, it's like 5,000 degrees Kelvin. It's so hot that most of the light that it shines is what we call visible light. We call it that because we can see it, because we evolved here. So it's sort of a little circular thing we have going there. But the Earth is also pretty much like a black body, but it's cooler, so it's mostly in the infrared. So the visible light is the more energetic light. It takes a higher temperature to get there. The other part, though, is that when you increase the temperature, the whole curve sort of bulks up. And the part that really matters to us at this point is the total energy. So this spectrum tells us how intense the light is, how bright the light is at some given frequency. But if we want the total rate of energy leaving the thing, there's a formula for that. And I'm going to show you to you in a second. But it also, you can get it, you can sort of visualize it as the area under the curve. So if the object is sort of cold, the total amount of energy leaving that object is proportional to the area under that curve. And you can see that when the temperature goes up, the curve gets bigger. And so the area under the curve gets bigger, and there's more energy leaving that object. So there's a formula for this. Yes? The total energy is measured. The total energy flux. This is a very good question, and we were going to get to it, but I'm glad you asked anyway, because it shows that you care. That's nice. The total energy flux will be in units of watts. So watts, you learned in lab this week, or will, are an energy flux. So a watt is actually a rate of energy flow given by joules per second. Or, you know, a watt is equal to joules per second. So if you see watts, you can always just substitute joules per seconds in that. And you may find that trick helpful when doing the lab. And so you've got some object. How much energy does it radiate? It depends on the surface area of the object. So what we end up with is watts per meter squared. So that's the total energy flux. I forget what letter I used in the text. We'll call it I, the energy flux, and it's in units of watts per square meter. So I'm going to indicate the units with sort of little brackets there. And now here comes the formula. The first term is epsilon. It's the emissivity. And this number goes from 0 to 1. It's a measure of whether the object is a black body or not. So equals 1 if it's black. So this spectrum here let's just clean this up a little, and draw two different spectra, one for something that's black and one for something that's not. This is a black body, has a nice smooth, you know, curve, and something that's not a black body might look like that, for example. So it's like a piano that's missing a bunch of notes here and here. And so you put some thermal energy into the piano, you pick it up and drop it an inch or something with the dampers off, so all the strings are vibrating. And you hear a bunch of notes down a low end and some middle and some way in high, but you're missing some here because the piano is missing those strings. So that is an object that's not a black body. And so in that case, the emissivity will be less than 1. For that. So emissivity has no units. It's just it goes from 0 if something had no oscillators to 1 if it's a black body. So that's the first term. The second term is a constant that you can look up in a book, and we'll be using this in lab next week, and you'll be we'll give you the value of it. It's the Stefan-Boltzmann constant. Stefan. The Greek letter is sigma. And it's just a number. The number happens to be 5.67 times 10 to the minus 8. That's how I remember it, because it's 5, 6, 7, 8. But and then there are units to that that you have to pay attention to, which we'll talk about in just a second. And then the third and final term in this equation is the temperature. And the temperature here is raised to the power of 4. So epsilon sigma T to the fourth is the formula for calculating how much energy is leaving some object. And we want the units to be watts per meter squared on the you know, for the total thing here. The units of epsilon, there are no units, it's just a number. Clean up house a little here, so we can think about units. The units of temperature are in kelvins, and that's all raised to the fourth power. And so if we want this equation to work out properly with the right units, we've got to put some units on sigma there so that everything cancels out and comes out the way we want it to be. So we don't have any kelvins on this side, so we've got to cancel this kelvin to the fourth. So we got to have on the bottom here a kelvin to the fourth. And we got to have watts per meter squared over here someplace. And so it turns out that the units for sigma have to be watts per meter squared per Kelvin to the fourth in order to make this all work. So if you had this formula, you looked it up, and you're trying to make it work, and you're getting goofy results, the thing to do is to look at the units and see, you know, are you doing it right, or are you, you know, multiplying apples by oranges and trying to get tangerines out of it or something like that. The units will kind of take care of you. You always, it's real important to pay attention to those. Okay, so an object radiates energy at that. Yes, yes. Well, this is the intensity of energy leaving an object in watts per meter squared. So epsilon has no unit. Sigma is watts per meter squared per Kelvin to the fourth, then multiplied by temperature in Kelvins raised to the fourth power. So now the Kelvins are going to cancel, and we have watts per meter squared on both sides. And we're going to use the formula now, so that kind of always solidifies things. I mean, a formula just floating by itself in a blackboard with nothing else on it is kind of mystifying, right? But we're going to use it now, actually, to make our very first climate model. So that'll help sort of make it a little concrete, too, I hope. So the question is, how does the energy flowing in and out of the Earth affect the temperature of the Earth? And we can take our first stab at answering that question right now. So the idea is that we have sunlight that is the source of energy coming into the planet. And then we have infrared light shining in all directions, which is how energy leaves the planet. Now, we can't control anything about how bright the sun is from here. That's kind of like an external driver to our climate. But we now know that the rate at which the energy leaving the planet depends on the temperature of the planet. So that's how we're going to get at the temperature. That's what's going to control the temperature, by balancing the energy coming in. So the energy coming in is given by a number called the solar constant. And this is in watts per square meter. And it turns out to be something like 1,350 watts per square meter. Now, this depends on how far we are from the sun. So the solar constant is different for Mars or Venus than it is for the Earth. And actually, the sun, the intensity of the sun isn't as constant as all of that. So the Stefan-Boltzmann constant is 5.67 times 10 to the minus 8 watts per meter squared per Kelvin to the fourth, and that's it. You know, maybe there's some more decimal points on the end, but whatever the number is, that's what it always stays. But the sun gets a little brighter and a little dimmer sometimes, and so it's sort of misnamed the solar constant, but there it is anyway. So that's the intensity of the light passing through a square meter perpendicular to where the light's coming from. Because if you were to, you know, have a square meter like a light sensor and you point it sideways, then you wouldn't see any of the light. So you point it straight ahead, that's the intensity of the light. But now some of this sunlight gets reflected. So the difference between reflected and absorbed, absorbed light, you've got visible light comes in from the sun, and then it makes heat on Earth which then shines as infrared. That's what light absorption is, and that's what, you know, that's what's keeping the Earth warm, is the light that gets absorbed. But there is some light that just gets reflected. So it doesn't enter into the heat budget of the planet at all, because it's actually just sort of bouncing off. So Venus in the night sky is one of the brightest, you know, after the moon, Venus is, and the sun, Venus is the brightest thing in the night sky. And it's not because Venus is so hot that it's a star. It's not making visible light because it's because of epsilon sigma t to the fourth and you know, because it's that bright. But it's just got these clouds, and so it shines, it just bounces the light off of the clouds and goes back out to space. So when you have reflected light, it's kind of like when you pay taxes before you get your paycheck. You don't get the energy. It's gone, you know, sort of subtracted off the top. So we have to take that into account. Using this term, where alpha is the albedo, which is the fraction of the light that gets reflected. So 1 minus alpha is the fraction of the light that gets absorbed. And it turns out that alpha for Earth is something like 33% of the sunlight that hits the planet gets reflected back out to space. Most of that is because of clouds and ice, actually, shiny stuff. Okay, so we've got now, this is just a fraction, so it's unitless. So we've got the units here are just watts per square meter. But if we want to talk about the energy for the whole planet, we have to get rid of that square meter part by putting in some sort of an area to adding it up over the whole planet. And this gets a little tricky because, I mean, looking at this wonderfully artistic rendering of a sphere, you know, there's at the equator at local noon, the sun is directly overhead, and 1 square meter here is really getting 1,350 watts per square meter minus the amount that gets reflected. But let's say we have a square meter up here or here, which are still in daylight, sort of, like twilight, but they're not perpendicular to where the sun is shining. They're nearly the wrong direction. So how much they get per square meter is different than if it was straight, you know, if it was perpendicular to where the sun is coming. So we could do some, like we could do an integral where you add up all these different square meters on this hemisphere and figure out the total amount of energy the Earth gets. But that's the hard way to do it. There's an easier way to do it, which is just to recognize that the Earth is casting a shadow. The amount of sunlight that the Earth is intercepting is equal to the size of that shadow. So the shadow is a circle, and it has an area equal to pi r squared. So we're going to add that term. So r is the radius of the Earth. And now that's adding up all the sunlight that's coming into the Earth. So that's one of the two terms. That's in. Now we have to deal with out. Well, the rate at which that sphere is losing energy, we already know the formula for that, and you're going to know it in your sleep by the time you finish the lab next week. It is epsilon sigma t to the fourth. And the T here is the temperature of the Earth. And this whole thing, you remember, or I will remind you if you don't, has units of watts per square meter. You gotta pay attention to the units, because otherwise you just like a babe lost in the jungle. The units take care of you. So we got the top one, the incoming energy. So this is units of square meter. So that cancels, and so we got the energy coming into the planet just in terms of watts, like, you know, a wattage of a hairdryer or whatever. And that's what we want to do for the energy leaving the planet too, so we can set the two equal to each other. You got to have watts equal watts, not watts equal watts per meter squared or something like that. So we need an area here. And now the area that we're looking for is the area of the surface of the sphere, not the area of the shadow. So the shadow was kind of a tricky thing to come up with. But you know, now that we've got this thing and it's radiating infrared to space, you know, it's got some surface area, this sphere, it sort of makes sense that the surface area of the sphere is what we're looking for. Should make sense that that's what we're looking for. If it doesn't make sense, we should, you know, try to make it make sense. So the area now is the area of the sphere. Whereas this is area of the shadow, which is a circle. Here we want the area of the sphere, and that happens to be 4 pi r squared. Yeah. Well, we're assuming here, we're looking for a single temperature for the Earth. And that is an approximation. This is the simplest climate model you can possibly imagine, and there's a whole bunch of approximations that we're making here that are not going to be right. So we're going to talk about this model, and then we're going to spend the next, you know, like 4 weeks or something poking holes in it and figuring out how to fix it and make it right. And you've identified one of the ways that this is an oversimplification. The rate at which it's going to emit energy at any given place depends on the local temperature. So the temperature at the ground, you run that through epsilon sigma t to the fourth, you get a much bigger number than the temperature at the North Pole, where the temperature is lower. And then when you put it to the fourth power, it just makes a huge difference. So the answer to your question is that in reality, this will vary as a function of you know, place and time, and we'll talk all about that. But in this model, we're just looking for a single temperature, so we're saying that the energy comes in this one way, and then it sort of magically gets mixed around to the whole sphere, and now it's leaving in this other way. Yeah, so we're calculating an average. That's right, that's what we're doing. So you couldn't use this climate model to predict the weather, or even global warming. It doesn't even have the greenhouse effect in it, but it's a place to start, and then we're sort of going to build it up. Okay, so we want to set the energy in and the energy out equal to each other. So transcribing from up there, L times 1 minus alpha, so the solar constant, times 1 minus the albedo, times pi r squared equals epsilon sigma, so that's the emissivity, the Stefan-Boltzmann constant, just a number in a book, temperature of the Earth raised to the fourth power times 4 pi r squared. So we know everything in this formula except for one thing, which is the temperature. So it's easy to solve for what the temperature would be at which the energy fluxes are in balance with each other. If the Earth is hotter than that temperature, then it'll be losing heat faster than it's getting it, and so it'll cool down. And if it's colder than that temperature, it'll be warming up, and it'll eventually find the temperature at which it can balance the books. And that's what we're looking for. We're solving for that condition where the energy budget is in balance. So, you know, we can cancel pi r squared. It leaves this factor of 4 here. The epsilon, we're just going to assume this is 1. That's a number. This is 33%, 1350 watts per square meter. And then we just solve for what the temperature is, and that's our very first climate model. So I'm going to show you what we get by doing that, solving that problem for our three sister terrestrial planets, Venus, Earth, and Mars. So you get an idea of how these things vary. So first off is the solar constant for Earth. It's 1350 watts per square meter. Venus is closer to the sun, so that means that a square meter, you know, measuring how much light is going through it at the top of Venus is going to get more sunlight. And it turns out that number is 2600 watts per meter squared, and Mars gets a skinny little 600 watts per meter squared. The albedo, which is the reflectivity of the planet, very different between them. Earth, it's 33% of the sunlight goes skittering back off to space without ever really getting absorbed. Venus, because of these clouds, is very reflective. It has an albedo of 71%. So, you know, 71% of the sunlight that hits Venus just gets reflected back out to space, and it doesn't really warm up the planet. And then Mars is, you know, dry and dusty. There's some light that sort of bounces off of the rocks and soil on Mars. There's some ice caps near the poles, but it doesn't have the kinds of clouds or ice that Earth has, and certainly nothing like Venus. And so its albedo, reflectivity is lower. Something like 17% of the sunlight hitting Mars gets bounced off. So it's like paying a lower tax rate or something. So now we calculate the temperature. And the temperature we calculate for the Earth is way cold. It's 253 Kelvin, which, if that doesn't sound cold to you, I can translate it. That's something like minus 20 degrees C or minus 15 degrees Fahrenheit. As an average temperature for the planet, it is way cold. You know, the average for the planet, the temperature observed is something like 290 or 280 Kelvin, something like that. You know, nice 55, 60 degrees. The average temperature of the surface of the Earth is a lot warmer than we get from this calculation. Let's look at the other planets. The calculated temperature for Venus, astonishingly, is even colder than it is for Earth. Yes?
I'm just curious, are those results what you would need to solve for T and formula?
That's exactly where these are coming from, yes. Well, that's what this temperature... That's the units of that temperature. It has to be on the absolute temperature scale, because if you try to do it in centigrade, you know what happened if it's, you know, minus 20 degrees centigrade, then it kind of gets weird if you take the fourth power of a negative number. If the way this works is using the absolute temperature, so it has to be done in Kelvin. So the calculated temperature of Venus using this equation is 240 kelvins. That's even colder than this minus 15 degrees Fahrenheit that we got for the Earth, which is weird because, you know, Venus is closer to the sun than we are, and so it has a higher solar constant. It turns out that the reflectivity, though, more than compensates for that. It gets more sunlight at the top of the atmosphere, but it squanders most of it. And so what actually reaches the planet is only enough to keep it at 240 degrees Kelvin. Whereas the observed temperature of Venus is hot enough to melt lead at the surface. It's incredibly hot, 700 degrees Kelvin. And then Mars, we got the same story although somewhat less extreme. They calculate a temperature of 216 Kelvin, and the observed temperature is something like 240 Kelvin. So in all of these cases, for all three of these planets, the temperature that we calculate from our first climate model is way on the cold side, and we're going to remedy that next time by trying to put in a greenhouse effect. So if it weren't for the greenhouse effect, everything would be much, much colder.